Author and researcher Rosemary Ellen Guiley is known internationally for her extensive work in many aspects of what is referred to as paranormal phenomena. She has authored almost 60 books covering angels and guides, past lives and reincarnation, otherworldly beings, dreams and the afterlife, and a whole lot more. I've had the pleasure of knowing Rosemary for almost 20 years, and I've interviewed her on several occasions covering a variety of these subjects. But this one that we're about to discuss in this interview is perhaps one of the most interesting and mystifying of all, the afterlife. More specifically, Rosemary will share with you how afterlife messages can and do come through the dreamscape to millions of people and throughout recorded human history. This is a fascinating conversation. Have a listen. Rosemary Ellen Guiley, it's so great to have you back. How are you?
Busy as ever, Alexis. It's wonderful to rejoin you on your show and catch up on a lot of things.
Absolutely.
I've been continuing research in many directions in the metaphysical and paranormal fields and doing a lot of traveling and investigations, so always a full plate.
Always a full plate for you. Well, speaking of a full plate, we were just chatting offline, and you know, I was under the understanding that you had written close to or maybe just north of 50 books. You're telling me that you are approaching 60 books in print. Wow. Some of them, of course, most notably on dreams, including your well-known Encyclopedia of Dreams. And so you got another book. Now, is this going to be 60 for you or just approaching 60?
I think I'm still approaching. I'm somewhere between 55 and 60, and I haven't tallied up in a while, and I've come out with two or three new books.
You sure have.
Just this past year alone. So I'm sure I'll hit 100 at least.
I'm sure you will too. Well, you know, as sort of a neophyte author, I'm just bowing down to you right now. I think that is just incredible work, and the subject matter that you cover is something that I don't think we'll ever get tired of, so you can just keep going writing those books. Today we're going to talk about your latest book, which is Dream Messages from the Afterlife, and this is going to be meaty because I don't think anyone will ever get tired of talking about this mystery we call the afterlife. But I want to ask you, what inspired you to write this book at this time?
Some of it had to do with my own experiences. When I was a kid and my interests were being shaped, some of the impetus came from my paranormal experiences. And a lot of it came from the dream world. My mom was a big psychic dreamer, and that got me very curious about how our dreams access other realities, and they access the distant past and the near and distant future as well. So I've always paid attention to my dreams, and especially from a spiritual perspective. So talking to people, facilitating dream work, I've been a dream work facilitator as a layperson since the early 1990s, you know, helping people understand their dreams, and keeping dream journals all of my life, I have recognized that many times our dreams are not just about us, you know, the ordinary dreams that we have about our day-to-day affairs and situations in life. Our dreams provide a medium for encounters with the dead, encounters with angels and spiritual beings, and other realities. And the ancients knew this. The ancients always valued dreams as this bridge between our world and other realms that are inaccessible to us. So I've had experiences throughout my life of encounter dreams, which always had a powerful impact on me. And it felt like the time was right for this. There's so much focus on the afterlife and proof of the afterlife, you know, near-death experiences, people's visionary experiences. And our dreams are one of the most powerful ways that we get direct personal evidence of survival and the existence of the afterlife, and also the continuity between the living and the dead.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that you mentioned Dr. Physicist Fred Allen Wolf as talking about the dreamscape, perhaps, as a literal parallel dimension, another reality. And I know this is a loaded question, but for those that haven't, I mean, I don't know that any of us fully understand what that constitutes. But what are these parallel dimensions, Rosemary. How is this so? And why would the dreamscape be the access point, or at least one of them?
The afterlife is considered in many systems of thought to be the astral plane. And from an occult perspective, from a spiritualist perspective, that's how it would be explained as a dimension that is accessible from our reality, a place where we go when we lose the physical body. And from there, depending upon your beliefs, you would progress into various stages in a new existence, or perhaps you would reincarnate and come back to Earth, or maybe even go to another world altogether.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the scientists say that we have a reality comprised of about 11 dimensions, and that these really are wrapped around ours, or paralleling ours. So they're really tied to us, the Earth, and our concepts of the universe. But they're planes of existence that aren't accessible to us most of the time. They vibrate at a different spiritual rate. That's from the spiritual perspective, not the scientific perspective. And that these parallel dimensions, one of them could be the afterlife. So whether you call it the astral plane or a parallel dimension, it's another plane of existence that has a link to us on Earth. And when we are in extraordinary states of consciousness, we have glimpses of these parallel dimensions. I've always believed that this is where we encounter things like the ghosts of the dead, mysterious creatures, alien beings, what we call extraterrestrials, they're really interdimensionals, fairies, the residents of the unseen realms that we encounter from time to time, they're really tied to the Earth in parallel dimensions. And so it is with the afterlife, at least the immediate afterlife.
Mm-hmm.
I think the afterlife is composed of stages of change and growth. And that when we die, we go into a transition stage. That what many people call heaven or the afterlife is the entry point to other stages of existence that we might not even be able to comprehend.
Mm-hmm.
And people might spend varying times, lengths of time in the afterlife where they can communicate back with people on Earth. There's a tremendous impetus for people who've passed on to let the living know that they're okay, that nothing nothing bad happened to them. They made it to the afterlife. They're happy. They're fine. They're restored. They didn't just disappear, and that they will always love those that they left behind. That is such an important connection.
Mm-hmm. And you actually spent a lot of time giving us the methods by which our loved ones might communicate that message, and I want to get into that a little bit. But before we do, I want to bring up something. When you mentioned the possibility that the afterlife, or at least the entry point to the afterlife, might be, who knows, maybe another world, this parallel dimension. And I want to tell you a little story about, I don't know if you're familiar with Dr. Ronnie Kildee. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right. It's actually a longer name, but she's also referred to as Ronnie Kildee. She's a Finnish doctor, a physician, who has been studying parapsychology, including the afterlife, for many years. And, I was watching an interview with her not so long ago in which she, see if I can sum this up, she talks about, one of the things that she also covers is alien abduction. And she talks about a gentleman, and she mentioned his name, but I can't think of it, who gave testimony of being abducted by these beings who, and I'm gonna fly through this literally to get to the point, basically took him aboard their ship, brought him to the dark side of the moon. I know this is going to sound fantastical to many people, but the bottom line is, and then eventually ended up on another, what he described as a physical planet, and they got out. And when he got there, he said he almost had a heart attack because who was there? His dead relatives and friends. He saw them. This is testimony. We can't say whether this is actual or not, but this is testimony that she communicated. And so when I was reading that, you know, in your book about the possibility of parallel dimension, I thought, my gosh, you know, we're getting glimpses of this, little anecdotes coming out. Could our loved ones actually be existing, albeit in another body, physically in another world?
Well, indeed, and I think they do. And that kind of experience, I hear similar experiences like that all the time. And they are subjective, but yet they all have amazing similarities in terms of the patterns things that people experience, you know, how they access these other worlds, their descriptions of them, and what they find. And they become articles of faith for people.
Sure.
That because we can't prove these things in any sort of physical way, at least not yet, nonetheless, when people have these experiences, they are so powerful and so real that people take them on board as evidence, as real evidence, that this is something, a real event that happened, and they now have a new truth, and it is a very transformative kind of energy then.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important to acknowledge these experiences and to allow them to exist as real events. And that's usually what happens with people when they have any kind of encounter with the dead, where they glimpse another reality or the dead person comes into their environment. It's an experience that is so real. It engages all of the senses. And it is as real as having a conversation with someone across a table in a restaurant. You know, it's that kind of reality where you know where you are and you know that the person you are talking to is real, not your imagination.
Mm-hmm.
So we're provided these glimpses of these other realities, and it's my belief that our consciousness, which is always evolving, at some point we'll be able to access these realities on demand at will. And right now we don't understand the mechanisms for them. They're often spontaneous.
Mm-hmm.
And when people try and have these kinds of experiences, they're usually not very successful. The dead also tell us that the windows of opportunity are very limited, and it takes a great deal of energy to have that sort of link. So it's all very tantalizing. And when you look at the evidence that has been reported over the centuries, human beings have had otherworldly encounters with all kinds of beings, and also with the afterlife and the dead, and the similarities from century to century in terms of what people encounter, they're really amazing.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know that we'll ever have any instruments to measure the validity of this, but certainly based on anecdote alone, and as you said, you know, not just a cornucopia of anecdotes here and now, but bridging all of history, you know, I think it's the Whately's Law of Evidence, a law that says when a certain amount of people experience something or say that something is so, it's so. So I don't know. We may have to just be okay with that. But it's a fascinating and such a full and still mysterious topic. So there's lots of questions I have. You know, you in your book, you talk about the different types of afterlife dreams that we might have. You talk about farewells, unfinished business, reassurance dreams. Talk about that a little bit. In fact, you spent a lot of time really going through the types of after-death communications that happen in dreams.
They do fall into different patterns and themes, and it seems to be what's most pressing on the part of the dead to convey. Well, the most common sort of visitation from the dead is a reassurance dream, to let the grieving loved ones know, hey, I'm all right. Don't worry about me. Their most frequent messages are, don't worry about me, don't grieve for me, because I'm okay now.
Mm-hmm.
It was my time to go. And things are okay where I'm at. It's really wonderful here. And if they've had health problems or they died of a progressive illness like cancer, when they show themselves to the living, they're often restored, and they look more youthful and in perfect health and quite a bit of radiance. So it's very comforting to the living to get these kinds of messages. And while a dream visit is powerful and goes a long way to alleviating grief, it it's not necessarily a magic thing that just erases all grief. But many people report that after these experiences, they are able to be at rest about concern and worry faster and far more effectively than they would arrive at that point, for example, through a traditional therapy and counseling.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, but the thing is that not everybody has these dreams.
And
people often wonder, well, I read that individuals have these visits. How come I didn't get one?
Mm-hmm.
Or my husband died. Why did my best friend have a dream visit from him and I didn't?
That's exactly.
Why did my sister get the dream?
It
seems to have to do with the pathways of spiritual energy, the way people dream, that these are experiences that look for the best possible opening. And so that's how the message gets through.
Yeah. It's like you were reading the next question off of my page, because that was it, you know. And we hear this so often that, in fact, I had the graphic artist that did the cover for my book I was just telling you about was telling me about an experience that his parents had. His father had lost a colleague from work that he was quite close to, and I think on the way back from the services, his mother, the wife, had never met, I don't think she ever met, or if she did, she didn't know the gentleman that well that passed, but she got the message. There was a message that was delivered through her, and I can't remember the circumstance, whether it was a dream or a waking message, but we were having the same conversation. That's very fascinating to me, and it seems that would make sense, that they would find the path of least resistance. And, you know, then we could ask, well, where's that resistance coming from? If, you know, you lose a loved one that you're thinking about constantly, where would the resistance be? Is this an electrical thing? Is it an energy thing? What's going on there?
It is a matter, I think, of spiritual vibration, that these planes of existences, they have their own frequency that they vibrate at. And if you're not at those right frequencies, it's going to be entirely invisible to you, even though it might only be an eye blink away, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And I have likened the process to electricity, because electricity follows the path of least resistance.
Right.
And so that's how these dreams seem to go, is that there's a push of energy to have the contact. And it is a limited energy. It's not unlimited by any means, and it has to find the best possible receptor in order to get the message through. And, of course, it's not going to go to a total stranger. It's going to go to either the intended recipient or at least someone who's likely to deliver the message.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, these veils between the worlds, they don't open very easily. Even the dimensions that other beings live in on our planet, and certainly there seems to be a very strong barrier between the world of the living and the world of the dead. Why that's in place, nobody can really give a good answer to. You know, other times it was like, well, you passed into heaven or hell, you know, for eternity, and so you were no longer of any concern to the earth, and it was no longer of any concern to you. We have so many people now with evidence of reincarnation and continuing contact that those arguments don't hold anymore. If the barrier were that easy to open up, we would be able to have contact on demand. We would be able to have visits. What would prevent us, for example, theoretically, from visiting the afterlife and then coming back? These things don't seem to be possible in our present state of spiritual development, but I do believe that if we continue to expand our consciousness and pursue spiritual endeavors, we have the potential for at least opening up those doorways more than they open now.
Mm-hmm. We've talked about this before, Rosemary. We've also talked about the conundrum of why those veils on the one hand seem to be so difficult, so thick, they seem to be so opaque, but on the other hand, with what's going on right now in the magnetosphere and the possibility that we could be looking at an eventual pole reversal from an energetic standpoint, that perhaps those veils are slowly starting to thin. So there's a lot of variables here, right? There's a lot of things going on.
There certainly are. And just from about the mid-20th century on, we've had an increasing awareness of spiritual topics. And, of course, these things have gone through cycles in the past. We've had, dark ages and renaissances, so to speak, of interest in these areas. But you mentioned the magnetosphere, and yes, we have environmental changes which are impacting these energetic terrains, where the barriers might be shifting or might be more permeable. We also have a global media, a global consciousness, and when you consider just in the past few decades, how we are bombarding ourselves with increased electromagnetic radiation mm-hmm. through cell phones, computers, the internet. All of these things could be impacting these barriers and also our consciousness. It has seemed to me for at least the last decade that more people are having more extraordinary experiences. It's hard to track because some of it is self-reporting. You know, people, I think, are inclined to volunteer these things more mm-hmm. than they have been in the past. But even taking that into account, it seems that the actual incidence of paranormal and spiritual experiences, the incidence is actually on the rise.
So are you saying that perhaps, now we hear so many of the negative effects of the electromagnetic pollution that we're surrounded by, but are you saying that in this case it could actually be aiding in thinning the veil, so to speak? Could it be doing that?
It certainly could have that impact of thinning the veil.
That's but interesting.
It might also be thinning all kinds of veils, and some of them may be good benefits and some of them may be detrimental to us. For example, if we have barriers between us and other beings who share the planet with us, who might be friendly, might be neutral, might be hostile, we could find ourselves engaging with these entities on a regular basis. And would that create problems for us, territorial problems? If the veils between the afterlife and the world of the living thin, then how is that going to impact physical life in our reality? One of the things that George Norrie and I speculated on in our book Talking to the Dead, mm-hmm. which concerns the push for better spirit communications, that if we have free access to the afterlife, are we going to get into, again, territorial things? Would we ever wage war on the dead, for example? We wage war on each other all the time. So if the afterlife looked like something that was beneficial to conquer, would we go into that? So there are so many far-reaching ramifications. And like you mentioned earlier, Alexis, you know, some of these things really stretch the mind and the boggle point. They're not out of the realm of possibility.
Right. Yeah, really something. So as I think of, you know, of course your book is based on, the afterlife perhaps coming through the dreamscape. You know, I think about people today, we talk of all of our devices that are around us, including televisions, but guess where many of them reside? In our rooms, in our bedrooms. You know, I personally don't keep my iPad or my iPhone near me when I sleep, but I'm wondering if that, you know, as we're weaving all of this together, could have an impact as well. So many people falling asleep with their TVs on, the larger screen TVs, iPhones and iPads right by them, or cordless phones. All of this is providing electromagnetic matrix that might indeed, this is just total speculation, but if in fact, I don't know whether your research has shown that you're getting more of these afterlife dream accounts reported, that could be happening as well.
It certainly is a factor that should be taken into consideration. And, again, because we're dealing with subjective processes here as well, it's extremely difficult to measure things precisely or even approach it from any sort of scientific paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
But my personal belief is that these sorts of things near us when we sleep could certainly impact our dreaming consciousness, perhaps even the way we dream. Since ancient times, it's been understood and accepted that the gods, so to speak, and by that I'm including the dead and other spirits and entities, have access to us through our dreams, access that is possible by the dreaming consciousness that is not as accessible during waking consciousness. So if we alter our dreaming consciousness in certain ways, perhaps we are making that access much easier.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So now everyone's going to bring all of their devices to bed with them, because again, I think there's such, and I'm not advocating that in any way. I think the dangers outweigh the benefits, but again, I think there's still such a desperation for us to know, to understand what resides on that other side of the veil. We just want to know. I want to talk about correlations between near-death experiences and afterlife dreams. You touch on that in your book, right? What's going on there?
They do have a lot of similarities in terms of the characteristics of the experiences themselves, and sometimes the nature of the messages and the content of the experiences. For example, both afterlife dream encounters and visits with the dead and NDEs often involve unusual and brilliant light. The NDEers are often bathed in brilliant light. They may feel a rapid transport. Some of them describe things like a tunnel. In afterlife dream encounters, the environment that they're in, whether the dead person is coming into a familiar surrounding on Earth or the meeting takes place in some unknown location, the atmosphere is unusual. There are unusual colors, unusual intensity to the light, kind of like a backlit sort of thing. So it's an altered space kind of environment. There are the presences of the dead. Both NDEs and dream visits involve the dead, of course. Sometimes guide figures are present, like angels or spirit helpers. Even in afterlife dream visits, there may be a sense of transport, that someone rapidly goes to a place where the meeting takes place, or suddenly they are there. There's a suspension of time, mm-hmm. And also a sense of barrier that, and this pertains especially to dream visits that take place in unearthly locations, that there's an acknowledgement in the dream that the dead already belong to another world and that the living cannot go. In fact, sometimes the dead will say, you can't come. You can only go so far.
Right. Yeah.
I have a very limited time, and then I have to go back. And so the NDEer also reaches a point of no return, which is sometimes visual and sometimes just a sense that if they cross over a certain line, they are in the afterlife, and there's no going back to the realm of the living. Communication with dead and with other beings in both kinds of experiences is telepathic.
Mm-hmm.
So these are just some of the hallmarks that these two experiences share, and they are both about bridging the gap between the world of the living and the afterlife, the world of the dead.
Absolutely. All of these things, you know, when we speak of out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, you know, heightened states of ecstasy, meditation, all seem to be bringing us back to, or at least shifting our focus and our frequency, literally, in something that all somehow is connected. They all share common features, in other words.
They do, and they concern the same sort of thing, but they approach it from different perspectives.
Mm-hmm. Right. Getting back to all the different areas that you cover, like the farewell dreams, reassurance dreams, unfinished business, in your research, which have you found, Rosemary, to be the most common that people have?
You mean the common, most common kind of
type
virtual
of dream.
Experience?
You know, is it reassurance? I think you had mentioned that reassurance dreams are probably more prevalent than the unfinished business, and, you know, what have you found?
Oh, yes, by far and away, the most common dream visit is the reassurance one.
Mm-hmm.
There is a type of dream visit called the farewell, too,
yeah.
And those can occur during waking consciousness as well as dream consciousness, and it's the person who's just passed makes an appearance to say goodbye.
Right.
And they may come and be at the foot of the bed. Person feels like they wake up, and there's the individual at the foot of the bed. And they may say something like, goodbye, it's my time to go. They may not say anything. But the experiencer has the sense that this person has indeed just passed over.
Mm-hmm.
Not quite as common as the reassurance dream. And I think our grieving is what opens up the door to the reassurance dream. Although, conversely, if grief is too intense and too prolonged and too bitter, that can prevent an experience from happening. It's a barrier. But it seems that the dead respond to grief on the part of the living.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, some of them say that prolonged grief is detrimental to them in the afterlife because it's like carrying an anchor around. They're connected emotionally and spiritually to the living, and grief literally weighs things down on both sides of the veil.
Mm-hmm.
And as much as we like to have contact with the dead, some of them say that also holds them back. That if we are continually pulling on them to manifest, to make themselves known, that it prevents them from carrying on in the afterlife. Now, that's not a uniform thing. Just some of them say that, and
mm-hmm.
others seem to make themselves much more available.
Right, right.
The unfinished business dreams are interesting because they often relate to the locations of wills and legal documents, bank records, and things like that that the living need to probate a will, for example, and they don't know where they are. And there are some astounding cases on record of the dead coming back to say, well, you know, look here, or it's there.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes people have projects that they want completed. There are even, on the negative side, cases of grudges and vengeance. And people who have been murdered will come back to help solve their cases.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the chapter on unfinished business, Rosemary, was intriguing to me. And I know, you know, as we've talked about, some of this unfinished business may entail finding wills, probates, things like that. But you talk about the story of Zona Shu. This is a story that's very unique. It happened in the 19th century, I believe, and it has to do with a dream that may have led to a man's conviction in this person's murder. Can you talk about that?
It's the most interesting, certainly a ghost case on record. Probably never could happen today. But it did involve the suspicious death of a young woman named Zona Shu in West Virginia in 1897, in January 1897. And she lived in a very tiny community, a rural area, and a stranger came to town who was charming and handsome and kind of a con guy, and she winds up marrying him. And 3 months after they were married, a servant boy finds her body inside her house. And the circumstances are all very suspicious because the husband worked as a blacksmith, and he specifically sent the servant boy to the house to inquire whether or not his wife, Zona, required anything. And the servant boy finds her lying by the stairs with her neck kind of twisted in a funny angle. Well, by the time the doctor is summoned, the husband has already hurried home and fixed up her wife's body, and he won't let the doctor touch it. He weeps and wails and goes into all these hysterics. He's put a very high collar around his wife's neck, and so the doctor is unable to do a complete examination, and her official cause of death was ruled as childbirth, which nobody really knows whether or not she was pregnant, but since many women died in childbirth, it was often just kind of a catch-all cause. Well, to cut to the chase, this all didn't set well with Zona's mother, mm-hmm. who suspected this ne'er-do-well son-in-law of hers of foul play. And after Zona was buried, she prayed that Zona would come back from the dead and tell her the truth about what really happened. And according to her testimony in court, Zona appeared on four nights in her room and told her mother that her husband had choked her and broken her neck in a fit of rage because he thought she had no meat to cook him for supper. And so she, Zona's mother went to the attorney, the town attorney, prosecutor, and demanded that her daughter's body be exhumed and reexamined. She prevailed, and it was. It was determined that her neck had indeed been broken. And so Shu, her husband, was charged with murder. During the trial, the prosecution actually was not going to admit the evidence of the dreams because the attorney was afraid that the jury would consider this to be imagination or hysteria on the part of Zona's mother. But actually, the defense brought it up in an attempt to discredit the mother, and it backfired. She was able to discuss the dream visits in detail, and the jury wasted no time in convicting the husband of murder. He was sent to the state penitentiary. There was a lynching attempt on him from angry residents. Then he was sent to the state penitentiary in Moundsville, West Virginia, where he died of some epidemic.
Wow. Oh, my gosh. When I read that, I thought that is really something. I mean, you know, we have heard these cases ever so often where the police will engage a psychic for an unsolved crime. So it's not that it's these types of things, this type of information coming from a realm that we still don't understand is not, you know, ever considered. But this was quite unique to me. That's amazing. And again, what can we learn from this? You know, this, again, I'm always somewhat outspoken about, you know, people being so vehemently in denial of this type of reality when in actuality it could be helping us so much on so many different levels if we'd start to take it more seriously. That was a very, that was a compelling case to read, absolutely.
And, you know, it would never be admissible in court today. Mm. At the very best, the evidence against the husband was circumstantial. Even with the testimony from Zona's mother, there was still nothing that could link him directly to the crime,
right.
Other than this testimony from the dead woman,
right.
Who came back in a series of dreams. And in one of the dreams, she even turned her head around 360
yeah.
degrees clockwise to
oh.
demonstrate that her neck had been completely broken.
Wow.
So how psychics handle this today, it does get to be very sticky. If a psychic has contact with a murdered person and learns information that leads to the solving of the crime, the evidence really has to be something that links the accused directly to the crime.
Mm-hmm.
And a story, you know, testimony from the afterlife just would never fly in court today.
Mm. Yeah. Well, maybe one of these days we'll learn to... It's difficult. I mean, it's apples and oranges. The judicial system is based on left brain And all of what we're talking about, where this information, albeit valuable, is coming from the right or less, you know, tangible realms. That's something fascinating. I want to talk about, we're recording this interview on September 11th. It will air as everyone's listening to it the following week, but I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up a book that you mentioned in your book by, and I won't get her last name right, Bonnie McGinnany, who wrote Signs, Visits, and Premonitions from Loved Ones Lost on 9/11. And I thought you could maybe make a mention or two about her book and how that melds into what we're talking about here. I know that she had lost her husband as well. Was he on one of the planes that crashed? No. I think he was in one of the towers, World Trade Center towers.
He was in the North Tower. And up on the 105th floor, and nobody on that floor had a chance. Bonnie's book is very moving. She had some experiences in the aftermath of 9/11 where she felt her husband's presence, and in talking to other survivors, discovered that they had had a variety of afterlife visits, signs, synchronicities, and some amazing dreams as well. And she also goes into some of the premonition dreams that she learned about, where either the people who were going to die in that disaster or their loved ones around them had disturbing dreams prior to this, where some of them were certain that they were going to die at some point in the future, but they didn't know how. And even her own husband, who had survived the first bombing of the World Trade Center in the early 1990s, I think it was 1993, made comments that he thought he was going to die in the World Trade Center.
Wow.
These sorts of experiences then take on an extra poignancy. And they really do bring comfort to people when even if we haven't had them ourselves, when we read about the things that happen, the visits that other people have, the reassurances they get, it does give us, the rest of us, hope, a sense of certainty, and that important word, reassurance, that even in the face of horrible disasters and violence, the dead make it safely to the afterlife where they are well.
Mm-hmm. This day, it's 12 years, hard to believe. It's one of those events where it will always seem like it was just yesterday, but so, you know, we've heard so many stories of these types of things. I don't know that I'd heard of Bonnie's book per se, but anecdotes that were flooding the internet very shortly after 9/11 in 2001 of these types of things, whether it be premonitions, and not just premonitions having to do with the victims and their immediate survivors, but just in general, people having dreams of something fortuitous happening, in the near future. So once again, the dreams provide a most powerful conduit. It's revelatory. And it's powerful. It's an access point for sure. You've had your own set of dreams, and one that you mentioned in your book is the afterlife and dream encounter you believe you had with your dad. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
It was a very powerful experience, and it happened about 2 weeks after my dad died. He had an aneurysm and died on the operating table out in Seattle, so I was not able to be present. And for many people, not being able to be there when a loved one passes is a lack of closure that adds quite a burden to grief.
Sure.
I was going through the normal grieving process. Certainly, it was a complete shock, my father's death, and 2 weeks after he died, I had this dream visit with him, and it had the customary hallmarks of these sorts of encounters. I was lucid, that is, I knew that I was in some sort of dream, but I was awake in the dream, and it felt very real. in these states of lucidity, you can feel things, you can touch things and feel them. There are heightened colors. The background was intensely lit with a weird kind of light. Hmm. Everything just, it's not an ordinary dream experience. Mm-hmm. But at any rate, I found myself back in my parents' home where I grew up, and I was sitting in a chair in the living room, and Dad was sitting in his favorite chair. My mother was in the house somewhere, but not present in the dream. And I'm looking at Dad, and all the communication was telepathic, mm-hmm. although it seemed like we talked. And I knew he was dead, and I knew that Dad knew he was dead, and that Dad knew that I knew he was dead.
Yeah.
I said, "Dad, what are you doing here? You can't be here. You're dead." And he started telling me about unfinished business. He had all these projects. You know, he died very suddenly. He was a busy man. And I'm sure he was like a lot of people who say, "Well, wait a minute. There are all these things I didn't get to finish. I didn't get to do." Hmm. And so we had this conversation then where felt that I had to persuade him that he had to move on. He could not stay on the earth plane. And at the end of the dream, the scene shifts, and I see him going off in the distance into this big building. And it was like, my sense of it was like a factory or something. Like Dad, what it conveyed was Dad going to work.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes off into the distance. So I felt that I had helped Dad make his transition. Now, what I didn't know was that for 2 weeks after my dad's death, my mom could feel him in the house very strongly. She had a lot of psychic ability, and she would walk into a room or come in from the outside and know that Dad was in the house and exactly where he was.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, all of a sudden, after, 2 weeks, he went away.
Isn't that...
I thought the timing was so...
Wow.
It's not a coincidence.
No.
I don't think that Dad was making his transition, that he wasn't quite earthbound because he wasn't stuck, but he wasn't moving on either.
Huh.
And that my encounter with him... gave him the persuasion and the impetus to move on then into the afterlife, and that correlated with the disappearance of his presence in the house.
And so your mom, you're saying you found out after you had the dream that your mom had been getting this sense of his presence in the room, in the house.
Yes, which made the dream even more remarkable because the
right.
mom had told me that. And she said, I still feel Dad around. I'm, concerned. Maybe isn't, going to where he needs to go. That could have triggered an anxiety dream.
Sure.
For me.
Mm-hmm.
In which, I would have that kind of scenario. Even so, would it make it any less real? Not necessarily. But the circumstances surrounding the dream were quite remarkable.
Yeah.
And that was the only dream encounter like that I had with Dad. He did appear in many dreams after that, but it was more of a symbol in what I would call ordinary dreaming,
mm-hmm.
Rather than one of these intense, powerful, energetic, realistic encounters where you feel that you are literally in the presence of that person.
Right. That is utterly, it's one story after another, but Rosemary, that's utterly amazing. I think, we in the research community in this area, we hasten to use the word proof. We're afraid of using that word, but in terms of evidence of, an actual interaction taking place, this is a powerful one. That is amazing. How long ago was that?
That was in 1983.
Wow. Do you still dream of him?
Every now and then, not as often. And some of that could be due to, the lessening of grief over a long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
But I've always had the sense that Dad moved on into some other reach of the afterlife that was beyond my ability to connect to him.
Mm-hmm.
I think that this happens,
yeah.
that the dead have things to do in the afterlife, and especially after they move out of the transition phase of things, there may be other vibratory levels of existence and change for them that we can't even conceive of.
Mm-hmm.
It would be very remote to us.
Mm-hmm.
And who knows, he may have even reincarnated.
I was just going to ask you, have you ever thought of that he may in fact be here? And boy, that's of course a whole nother discussion, but wouldn't it be neat if we could know that? And, you know, there's some researchers that believe that those that are reincarnated sort of stay in the same familiar environment. So, in fact, you could be interacting with him now and not know it, but that's amazing. Do you get a feeling? Do you have a feeling about that, or are you just sort of passe one way or the other?
I suspect Dad has reincarnated.
You do. You do, huh? Isn't that something? Wow. Our loved ones, they are truly never lost. And, you know, not only are our parents and our, you know, human loved ones important to us, but our animals are too. And this, as you probably know, touched me greatly. You talk about animals in the afterlife. And of course, I think our listeners know, I've talked about my little kitty so much, Paws, and who I believe to be perhaps the reincarnated Paws, Clover Paws. So I obviously wanted to get into this a little bit about animals in the afterlife. Tell us about that.
Well, animals come and visit us in dreams as well. And people often have experiences of their presence in a house. They will hear a cat or a dog walking, an animal jumping up on a sofa or bed or lap even. I've had accounts where people say they feel an invisible presence of a cat on their lap, and they can even feel the sensation of fur if they reach out to stroke it. And they also visit in our dreams. And animals convey messages telepathically, too. Every pet owner who has been close to their pet, no matter what kind of pet it is, feels a rapport, an emotional rapport, and the ability to convey thoughts and moods and impressions and to receive those back from the animal.
Mm-hmm.
And so these kinds of dream visits can be very reassuring as well, because we grieve our pets just like we grieve our human loved ones.
No question. Yeah, no question about that. You know, I just got an email, or I guess somebody had left a comment on the article that I had written on animals, reincarnation in animals, and I got a touching story of a woman who lost her German Shepherd just about a week ago, and she emailed me to say that she had what she felt was, well, she didn't describe it as a dream. She said she had a vivid sighting, an experience. Maybe it was a dream, but she said she could see these dogs through her closed eyes is how she described it, and she was in an unfamiliar room. But she saw this puppy, and she instinctively felt that it was perhaps the reincarnated German Shepherd. She comes to find out a couple of days later that the woman who, the breeder, who her previous dog was from, had just had a litter of pups. And so she felt instinctively that one of those pups was her reincarnated German Shepherd, albeit just a week, you know, within the time that the dog had passed. But what was so sad is that she said to me, I don't, you know, I really feel that this is my dog, but unfortunately my living circumstances won't allow me to have a dog anymore, so I'm very sad. People are so close to their animals, and I in my research have seen a rise in that that bond that we have made with our animal companions. So I'm glad that you covered that in your book. We're running out of time. I may stretch it a few more minutes because I want to get in a couple more things. One in particular that I have always found intriguing is that of deathbed visitations. I recently talked to William Buhlman, a mutual colleague, about that whole phenomenon. I really want to spend a few minutes talking about this because if there is one aspect or element to the validity of survival of consciousness or some otherworldly presence that exists, this would have to be number one for me. Talk about deathbed visits, if you would.
There are visitations and visionary experiences that people have as they near death, and these would be typically people dying of a terminal illness or complications from old age, where the dying happens in stages. The visionary experiences and visits can happen outward even a few weeks before someone passes, but they're more likely to happen, and they become more frequent the closer one gets to actual death. People describe heavenly scenes, beautiful scenes, usually parks and gardens. Sometimes they hear heavenly music. They see dead people who are connected to them come and visit them in their room. There may be angel helpers as well. These have been studied at length since about the turn of the 20th century. They came to the attention of people in the psychical research and parapsychology community who have documented thousands of them to look for patterns and explanations. No satisfactory explanation is advanced for them. It doesn't seem to be oxygen deprivation of the brain. It doesn't seem to be, hallucination or expectation. Regardless of somebody's religion, or even if they are agnostic or atheist, the visions are all very similar. So I find that to be very interesting, that this is not some sort of hallucination that might play into fantasies or expectations of what we will find in the afterlife. Sometimes people who are in attendance of the dying will have a vision of the person being escorted away at the time of death by beings, either the dead or spiritual beings. In parapsychology, they're called takeaway apparitions.
Hmm. Okay. Well, you do talk about the hospice workers. I have my own story I've told before, so I won't repeat it, but how they seem to somehow be linked in, energetically, if you will, or maybe just out of doing it so much, seeing it so much, that oftentimes they will see misty, remnants, maybe even a duplicate of the individual's body, rising up. And it's amazing. Talk about that a little bit.
All of these things have an emotional connection. And we've often speculated if the soul has any physical properties. You know, can it be weighed? Can it be measured? And the living who are in attendance of the dying have reported seeing mists and white clouds rise up off the body as the person passes. And that this might be some sort of visual apprehension of the soul, of the energy field that comprises the soul. It's not universal, and it doesn't happen all that often, that kind of sighting, but it is very intriguing and has some parallels to the astral body, the duplicate that we see, that some people see, I should say, of themselves when they find themselves catapulted out of the physical body. Mm-hmm. Not everyone sees their astral duplicate, which is kind of a milky gray white form that can just have the shape of a human or even have the details of their own body. But there are some parallels there between the two.
Hmm. Very interesting. If we were to put all that together, we have a case, I believe, for the afterlife. You know, many people have heard the story of Steve Jobs, the famous last words, if you will, on his deathbed, where he, I believe, looked... I suppose we could call it a deathbed vision. I don't know what you would call it, but I think his words were simply, wow, wow, as if he were seeing something that he couldn't believe. It was just, do you know what I'm talking about there?
I don't know the circumstances of his final moments, but it sounds like it corresponds to other comments that the dying make about, beautiful everything is.
Yeah.
You see something that's quite wonderful and beautiful and exquisite.
Yeah. Apparently the family members that were at his bedside reported that he had this wondrous look on his face and just repeatedly said, wow, or maybe it was, wow, look at that, or something like that. So certainly there's something going on here. Winding down, Rosemary, I want to ask you, at the end of the book, now I wouldn't call this necessarily a how-to book, but you managed to get into your book, in the back of the book, a little bit of a how-to exercise you call the dream-sending exercise, because I know you state earlier in the book that we can't certainly force these types of dreams to happen, but perhaps we can encourage, with no guaranteed results, of course. But talk about your dream-sending exercise. It's interesting.
I do wish to emphasize that these sorts of experiences, for the most part, can't be summoned at will, but we can make conditions more favorable for them to happen, and that's through the very ancient practice of dream incubation, where you set an intention prior to going to sleep that you will have a certain kind of dream. And people have used dream incubation for usually getting answers to questions, but it can be applied to having a dream visit as well, to ask before one goes to sleep to have a message from a dead loved one or a meeting with a dead loved one. We must keep in mind that these reunions are very purposeful. They're not for our entertainment or just to make us feel good. When the dead come to visit, they have a specific purpose. And once that purpose is accomplished, the meeting comes to an end.
Mm.
So here again, we can't just summon them up, I think, just to, like I said, make ourselves feel better. But if there's something we wish to convey, or a closure, or something we wish to learn, we can ask for those sorts of messages and meetings to happen.
Mm-hmm.
There may not be an actual encounter, but we might have a dream with a message in it.
Yeah.
We might even wake up with knowledge of an answer to a question.
So
it's certainly worth experimenting.
Absolutely. And, of course, there are other means by which, I suppose, our loved ones can come to us. That would be a whole other book, of course. But it seems like, as always, the dreams are that precious, what I call, access point to those realms that I feel on some level we're already connected to. So your book does a wonderful job at explaining this, and you really, almost number 60, I still can't believe it, this book, Dream Messages from the Afterlife, Dream Messages from the Afterlife by Rosemary Ellen Guiley. Rosemary, is it available right now for sale? Is it released yet?
Yes, it is.
Oh, good.
It's been out a few weeks, and it's available on my website, visionaryliving.com,
mm-hmm.
and also on amazon.com.
Perfect. Okay, well, as always, I recommend your work. You do incredible, incredible work looking into areas that most of us can't get our arms around. So thank you once again for joining me and having a full, wonderful, inspiring discussion. Rosemary Ellen Guiley, thank you.
Thank you, Alexis.
And take care.
Whether our loved ones come through to us just to reassure us that they're all right, or to guide us in unfinished business, or to connect just to say I love you and always will, Rosemary's research clearly points to the idea that those in the afterlife are very much alive and in many cases willing to connect with us and through us. Dream Messages from the Afterlife is filled with many accounts of loved ones who did just that, and in that process have shown us that the veil that we think may be impenetrable may be anything but. If you enjoyed this interview with Rosemary Ellen Guiley, you may also want to check out my interview with her where we discuss reincarnation and the New Age. Thank you for listening to Conscious Inquiry. Until next time, I'm Alexis Brooks.